They say I'm disturbed.
From city to city, an incredible hysterical panic spread.
I think we're getting into a weird area here.
Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy?
This hysteria.
You can't handle the truth. Truth.
Brain is gone.
This is Hysteria 51.
They're here.
The truth is out there.
It's alive.
But you won't find it here.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
Cut the music. Hey, David, I'm terrified.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lord. What? What's going on this time?
That conspiracy bot says climate change will kill us all.
That's true.
Well, he also says TCBY would rise up before 2025 and take its place as the true ruler of this planet. I mean, in addition to him, you know.
Hey, there is still time, so calm your tits, meat sack.
Nation, if you haven't guessed it... tits on a meat sack. Well, that just means you're sane. But we're talking about climate change this week.
That is correct. Climate change, among other things. But told through the lens of the Devil's Dictionary, a book not just with an amazing title, but an amazing author, one Stephen Kotler.
That's right. And just so you know, we are broadcasting from the lower fourth dimension, also known as Chicolorado.
Oh. That, I don't think that exactly rolls off the tongue, does it?
The fuck it doesn't. It's a work in progress. We are your hosts and lead planeteers this week. Brent is fire. I am heart. And the bots are running around like usual.
I don't run. I have wheels, you plebe.
God help us all. Good luck on steps. Anyway, to the man of the hour. Brent, tell us about Stephen Kotler.
Yes, Mr. Kotler. not exactly hey, Kotler.
I'm sure he has never heard that before.
Much like everyone that we have on here, his resume outshines us immensely. He's amazing. He's a New York Times best-selling author. We're talking 9 bestsellers out of this 13 books total. That is amazing. He's got a fascinating array of books, such as The Art of Impossible, Tomorrowland, The Rise of Superman, Last Tango in Cyberspace, which is a prequel to the book we're talking this week, and many, many more. Not one to rest, he's also an award-winning journalist. He's been nominated for 2 Pulitzer Prizes. Luckily for us, he hasn't won any, or he probably would have been on this show. And he's done his own TEDx talk. He's the executive director of the Flow Research Collective, a peak performance research and training institute that researches the neuroscience of flow states and trains individuals to harness the power of flow so they can achieve more faster. Interesting key note here, the way that we got in touch with him is they keep wanting to test me and try to understand how I have reached, as they call it, peak of human potential, and I just don't have the time, sadly.
Yeah, same here. I hadn't told you, but right. Same.
Beside that truth, near and dear to our hearts here at H51, Stephen is a dog lover and co-founder of Rancho de Chihuahua. It's a hospice and special needs dog sanctuary. How fucking awesome is that?
That is something. If I had the money, we'd be doing it out here right now ourselves.
That's like, amazing. Yeah. Lisa and I have worked with several rescues, and we still work with Chi-Town Pitties. It's where all of our mutts, our strays come from. And we donate time and money and everything to them. If you have the ability for pets or for people or whatever's in your heart, please do. And if not, well, we understand, but, you know, it helps make the world a little bit better of a place, and it makes up for the shit that we do on the side, you know. The capstone on this incredibly impressive resume, though, and I don't want to tell any tales out of school here, but he's now been featured on Hysteria 51.
Talk about peak performance.
Amen. So, time to brush up on his Wikipedia and all that stuff, I think is what we're getting at there.
Well, I think now he can move that tassel over to the left side, right?
He gets a new stripes that go around his shoulder. But it's a bolero.
Why does that metal look like a stain on your shirt?
It's none of your goddamn business. No,
it's none of your business, but if you have to know, it's made of hardened mustard, so shut up.
So there. So back to the story at hand, A Hardened Mustard. Now, Stephen's latest book, The Devil's Dictionary, it seeks to entertain readers while educating them about climate change.
I find climate change incredibly entertaining.
And that is right on brand, thankfully for us.
You didn't make any parts of him absolutely heat-proof, though, right?
I mean,
get out in the sun, it's going to be some problems.
Luckily, he's like me, and he avoids the sun at all times because, you know, lazy. Anyway, thankfully for us, and to the chagrin of one robot we know, rather than the usual doom and gloom approach, Stephen talks about how our happiness and success depends on overall happiness and success of the planet we inhabit. And that's kind of an important thing.
Exactly. He uses fiction not just to entertain, but to basically generate dialogue and discussions to alert others of climate change and shed light on existing technologies that could combat climate change now.
Yeah. Don't you just hate it when someone teaches you all the while being entertaining? The fucking nerve of some people. I tell you.
He lied to us through song. I hate when people do that.
And it released just in time for Earth Day 2022, almost like he's trying to prove a point. I don't know. I don't know about this guy. Oh, man. So anyway, The Devil's Dictionary addresses key conservation issues and explores groundbreaking ideas about how to preserve species and ecosystems, including... I'm not going to get into the whole thing. There's a few things, mega linkage, like large areas of rewilded lands, carbon suckers, the way they use like in places like Iceland that capture CO2, and biochar. It's a form of charcoal. They use in like green, vineyards across California to improve soil health.
And my weather dominator.
That was Cobra in the 80s, you hack. I'm pretty sure that wasn't that it? The weather dominator. Yeah, that sounds
the weather
about right.
Dominator. I don't know.
And unlike most cyberpunk.
It's just harp.
Right. Yeah. Unlike most cyberpunk sci-fi stuff, it's not a dystopian future it's set in. It's like one you would kind of want to be in. Why don't you give us a quote from Stephen?
Stephen says, I'm a big believer in the power of imagination to shape the future and the power of fiction to expand the imagination. I wrote The Devil's Dictionary to provide an alternative vision of our environmental future. If we can't imagine this possibility, we'll never create this future. I wanted to bridge that gap, but had no interest in creating a perfect utopian world. I wanted a near-term version of our world where we've battled back the worst parts of species die-off and climate change.
You're here. We're going to go to break real quick, and when we come back, Steve is going to join us, and we're going to talk all there is to know about The Devil's Dictionary and how it's actually satanic, and we pulled a fast one on you.
Actually, he's Ambrose Bierce, back from the dead.
On Hysteria 51. Hola, David. Me amo Brent.
Bonjour, Brent. Je m'appelle David.
You didn't do Spanish. I thought if we were going to do this together, we'd do the same language.
Oh, sorry.
That's on brand for us.
I just thought romance languages was the key.
Everything I say is romantic, and that is thanks to Rosetta Stone. You guys, we've been touting these things forever. We love Rosetta Stone, and we actually are users. David, you've really been using it even for longer than I. What's your experience been like?
Oh, it's been great. The thing is, you really get to learn how to speak and think in that language with it. So it's very high on pronunciation, too. So you can, you know, learn how to speak.
And, you know, our show is all about proper pronunciation.
In that pronunciation. Yeah, that's right. But they designed it for long-term retention, you know. If you don't get the pronunciation right, you say it until you do, and then, you know, that just seeps into your head.
Well, and that's why, you know, this has been trusted by experts for 30 years, and there's over 25 different languages that you can learn, and people, millions and millions of users use it because, like you said, it does seep in, and you're using it with, you know, you get speech recognition, and it hears you. You get to use, like, the built-in true accent features that gives you this pronunciation, which is super convenient, and you can do it at your own time. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm all about value, and you get a one-time purchase, 25 languages. If I learned all 25 languages, I'd be so confused or really cool. I'd go in and out.
But you'd be real marketable.
But literally, though, this is something that we use, and we have both of us have given the seal of approval because we want to do this long term, and it's something that it works, you know. And we don't do long term stuff like this. And this is the one that we've chosen, and we love it. So, all you guys got to do, don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now, as we've told you 1,000 times, and it's always now. Right now, get now. Started. For Larry limited time, Hysteria 51 listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
How much?
50%. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your unnatural life.
Wow.
Redeem, redeem, redeem. How do they do it?
Rachete, you're 50% off. Rachete. Redeem it. 50% off, rosettastone.com/today. Do it today. After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when Brent and I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, we thought, man, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. Brent is trying a plan right now and says that it works like a charm from Chicago to Nashville as he makes his big old move. Mint Mobile is working for him. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. And you can use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. So ditch the overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/hysteria. That's mintmobile, mintmobile.com/hysteria, hysteria. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/hysteria. $45 upfront payment required. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Welcome back from break, everyone, and welcome in Stephen Kotler. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
It is good to be with you, gentlemen.
How's it going? Are you enjoying the normal weather? Is it cold where you're at? You know, I guess it's an apt question to ask, going by what this book is about. How's it where you're at?
It's actually still a little cold, which is awesome.
Yeah, I'm in Chicago, and it's been warm here, and then David is in Colorado, so he's got different weather like every other day. What are you at, David?
Oh, it's very pleasant.
Yeah.
I was born in Chicago. I lived in Colorado,
you're a combination of both of us.
I got both of you guys covered. I'm a Midwesterner. Work hard, don't lie. I'm a Coloradan. When in doubt, throw yourself down mountains and high speeds.
Speaking of throwing yourself down mountains, I went skiing one time in my life, and I did the bunny slopes like 2 times. I'm like, I've got this. This is simple. And I went up the ski lift, and it was about the worst 3 hours of my life.
So we in the business of skiing, that is, have a phrase for that. I think we call that famous last words.
This looks so. I'll tell you, going straight is very, very easy.
Yeah,
it's the
you I tell pizza you what, and your French fry. You got it.
I tell you what they I tell you what they don't prepare you for is how hard it is on a hill to get your ski back on. Like when you're stopped, that was a lot of it.
Be fortunate you didn't have to learn at the time that they didn't have step-in bindings when the whole binding came off and you were attached to your ski by like a little rope. So you'd fall down the hill and your ski would be dragged behind you, beating you the whole time.
Stop hitting yourself. Yeah.
Stop that.
And again, this is the Ski Time Hour with Britt and Dave. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Your new book is The Devil's Dictionary, and it's actually a sequel to The Last Tango, sequel in sorts of The Last Tango in Cyberspace. It's a sci-fi thriller following the exploits of Lion Zorn. For our listeners, real quick, who might not be familiar, do you have like an elevator pitch to sum it up nicely? I know that's like a loaded question.
I'm going to do my best. I've got a high level, and then I've got one level down.
All right.
You sort of need. High level is this. I really believe that if you cannot sort of imagine the future, you can't create it. I've spent half of my life working on innovation and disruptive technology and things along those lines. And there's a, you know, pretty clear link between what we can imagine and what we create in the real world. And I kept reading these sci-fi thrillers about a world where like the great environmental challenges that we're up against kicked our ass, right? Mm-hmm. Every near-term sci-fi thriller was about this environmental apocalyptic world. And I wanted to create a world where the biggest environmental challenges that we were up against, say climate change and species die-off, like the rising extinction rates, had been solved. And my question was, what kinds of changes in society, both like as us, as people, as humans psychologically and technologically, would have to take place to create that world? So that's the backdrop. That's the world that's set in. It's our world, like 15 years hence, where these big environmental challenges have been sort of created. And it's sort of a story about two warring billionaires. Today, we've got billionaires who are like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, who are fighting to be the first dudes into space. In this environmental future, people are fighting to create mega linkages, these giant interlinked national parks. And our hero, our protagonist, Lion Zorn, gets hired by one of these billionaires to go investigate some very strange happenings at this kind of megalink, this giant national park he's trying to create. There are dead bodies start showing up and exotic animals never before seen on Earth, new species start showing up. And Lion Zorn gets called in to investigate. And, you know, it's a cyberpunk sci-fi thriller. So there's menacing shadow corporations and it, you know, sort of page turner from there.
It was refreshing though, that it is this cyberpunk noir type without the complete dystopian dropout, horrible world that they're living in. You know, I thought that was kind of nice.
The cyberpunk I sort of grew up on, Blade Runner, some of the early William Gibson novels, Neal Stephenson's Snow Crash, really early cyberpunk. They were dark worlds. There was a lot of, you know, dark shit going on in those worlds, but they weren't completely dystopian. They weren't entirely broken, destroyed. And broken, destroyed. First of all, I don't know why you'd set a noir. Noir is already dark. Mm-hmm. And if you got a noir in a broken, destroyed world, like you don't have a whole lot of emotional space to work with. Everybody is depressed.
Yeah,
and bad shit is happening.
If the detective is drinking, like everybody else is too, so what makes it special?
Exactly. So it doesn't, like, there's not, from a storytelling perspective, dark on dark doesn't give you a ton of wiggle room, you know, unless you're making fresh existentialist films.
Or a DC Comics movie. I mean, that's how that works.
Yeah. Well, see how well that's worked for them.
It's awesome. It touches on environmentalism, empathy, our relationship with the earth, and especially animals, and a huge dose of AI, all things that, you know, a lot of things we've talked about in here. How do you decide to tackle such a heavy topic through the lens of fiction? Because I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school. We've taken a collective shit on this planet and you're looking at it through a different lens. I know it deals a lot with your background, but what was your driving force for this?
Yes. I mean, so like driving force for the world was funny. I write, you know, half of my career is spent on human performance and working on the neurobiology of flow states. And the other half of my career has been spent working on kind of how do you use disruptive technology to solve grand environmental challenges. And on the disruptive technology side, a bunch of years ago, I was writing a book with Peter Diamandis called The Future is Faster Than You Think. And we were talking about exponentially accelerating technological lines of technology that were developing really, really, really fast. Like exponential means Moore's law. It means you're doubling periodically in strength and power on a regular basis. And there are about 12 different technologies that are proceeding on these exponential growth curves. And this has been going on for 15 years, and I've written a couple books about it. But what's happening now is they're starting to converge. So it's not just AI. It's AI is bashing into robotics. It's bashing into virtual reality. And it's creating stuff we can't even imagine. And that was exactly the problem. I'm researching this book with Peter. And I always like to say I'm a reporter. I'm not a futurist. Like when I write fiction, I'm writing fiction, man.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm a reporter. I'm a reporter. People who prognosticate about what's going to happen tomorrow, that's not, I don't do that. I'm not an expert there. And I try to stay in my lane. But Peter and I had to talk about what was going to happen over the next 10 years. And I couldn't wrap my head around it. So I paused our research, created a world where those things were true, and set a story in it. And then when I was looking for a way, what story do I set there? You know, the story I wanted to set was the story I always wanted to set, which is we know what the big environmental solutions are. So what happens when we start putting them into place? What happens to society and to culture? And how do we make that change quickly? That was sort of the backdrop to how I started thinking about the world.
When you look at like this, you know, the thought of like conservation biology and things like that, and then putting it through this, is it hard to write with a purpose like that, or does it come easy to you? I don't know if that I'm saying that correctly, but you know,
it's a great question. And in my opinion, rule one for my books, nonfiction or fiction, but I think this is doubly true for fiction. If you're going to read one of my books, it's going to take 6, 7, 8 hours based on reading time, but normal, that's where it usually comes out. You're going to do that. Give me 6, 7 hours of your life. That's a lot of time. We're all busy and there's a lot of other cool things to look at. And 7 hours is a lot of time. So I am going to give you a page turning, pulse pounding story where you're going to be laughing out loud at times. And you're also going to have your mind blown consistently because I'm really, you know, forcing you to think about some interesting, cool stuff. Right. That's sort of my trade with the reader. And if that's your trade with the reader, be wary of big moral purpose. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you're going to have themes, but if you start beating your reader over the head with your morality, it gets pretty freaking boring pretty fast. So it's a delicate line to toe or tightrope to walk, depending on which metaphor you want me to trample all over here. I did it and I was really, I tried to be very cautious with it because I didn't sort of want to beat the reader over the head with it. And that's sort of why I created the world I created, because the world does a lot of the heavy lifting, right? It's a world where these environmental challenges are being solved. So people have already a shift in mindset and psychology. A lot of the book is about how do we expand what psychologists call spheres of caring, right? A sphere of caring is basically how far does empathy extend?
Right.
And for most of it, it's like friends and family, and sort of maybe tribe and country, right? But it doesn't often cross the barrier of species. We don't like extend our sphere of caring into plants, animals, and ecosystems. And that's the general theme of the book, right? If we want to save the world, we need to develop empathy for all humans, of course, but also for all plants, animals, and ecosystems.
Right. And that was a huge part of this, because you have these people in your book, these empathy trackers, or these people that are, they're growing their empathies where they're feeling empathetic for not just themselves, but plants and animals and bonding with them in one way or another. And that's such a fun idea. And then you have other people that are getting it through a drug
you should know this is not all that weird. So I study flow, right? It's an altered state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. It's any of those in the zone, locked in. I'm so focused on what I'm doing that everything else just starts to disappear, and all aspects of performance, both mental and physical, tend to go through the roof. Flow expands a lot of stuff. Two of the things it expands naturally are empathy and what is known to scientists as nature-relatedness, ecological awareness, or sometimes cross-species empathy for all, feeling for plants, animals, and ecosystems. In flow, this naturally happens. We expand our sphere of caring, and especially if the flow states take place outdoors, we start really seeing and perceiving and caring about plants and animals and ecosystems. And that's one way of doing this that happens naturally. I do that work all the time in my research on flow. You can also do the same thing with psychedelics. This is well known. One of the coolest new papers to come out of Robin Card Harris's lab at Imperial College in London, where they do all the sort of psychedelic brain imaging work, is on nature relatedness. And he proved that if you do psilocybin, LSD, or I think he might have done MDMA, those three substances, while outdoors, it radically expands nature relatedness and directly, by extension, environmental activism.
Yeah.
So we know psychedelics will do this naturally. Flow will do this naturally. There's something about altered states that seems to do this naturally. So when I was looking for how do you get this shift to happen really fast in society? Well, of course, I introduced a super new fun drug that instantly produces cross-species empathy and allows you, I took it farther than where the science is right now, right? And allows you to sort of communicate with animals in a deeper, meaningful way. And that science sort of has been done too separately in different pockets of research. We've got AIs that can communicate with animals now and things like that. So like, I just brought all this shit together and put it into one thing.
Well, and then you had one of the most realistic things, which was you have these people that are becoming empathetic and they want to commune and take care of nature and animals. And then the other people that have these feelings and go, I don't give a shit because I'm human and we're better than the rest of them.
And that, I mean, the Humans First movement, like, it sounds sort of so strange, but I will tell you, my wife and I have for 25 years run animal sanctuaries. We do dog sanctuaries, hospice care, and special needs care. And
we are huge animal lovers here, so that is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. That's fantastic. Thank you. we did this work for a while in a very rural, very poor part of America. We wanted to work on the front lines, and this was a very Catholic part of America. And for a very long time, it's changed, actually, but the word hasn't spread. The Vatican told Catholics that dogs don't have souls, so they are not worthy of the same attention that humans are. So when we were doing animal work in this community, people would come up to us and they'd be really mad at us. Why aren't you helping children? Children need the help. Why are you wasting your time on dogs? And they'd be pissed. And that's a fairly extreme version of the Humans First movement. But like even the stuff that I rolled forward to create sort of our bad guys and our anti-heroes, they're based on stuff that exists today.
Right. And that's amazing and scary. I'll have to say.
Yeah, you think? I know, right?
I'm always like, where do they get the authority? They think, you know, somebody has made this up and said this is from God, and so therefore everybody else has to act this way that I myself have made up. Like, is it the Pope? Is it some bishops?
Here's my counter argument that I developed in that situation, because this is where it gets really difficult. Mm-hmm. So however you want to measure, like, consciousness, intelligence, awareness, whatever, right? So most people start with, can you feel pain? Yes, dogs feel pain. Do they have emotions? Yes, as it turns out, dogs not only have the seven basic mammalian emotions that all mammals, including humans, share, they have all our human social emotions. In fact, they're better developed than ours. So dogs, for example, are better at face reading than humans are. They can look at your face and know what you're feeling better than like anybody, but basically your wife or spouse kind of thing.
Debatable.
That's emotion.
that was my chuckle.
What did you say?
Debatable.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, my bad on that one. Sorry. But if you measure intelligence, just go by vocabulary. Most dogs, for English words, forget about dog language, right? But English words, it's between like 60 and 400 words. That's mm-hmm. about a 2 to 3 year old with the emotional development of a 3 to 4 year old, basically. That's roughly what you're saying. We euthanize through shelters roughly 8 million dogs a year. Yep. If we were euthanizing 8 million 3 to 4 year old children a year, people would go nuts. But that's essentially what we're doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is a staggering, to think of it that way is mind-blowingly terrifying.
It is. And, I lost my little one at the end of last year. She was so intelligent. she learned so many words over the course of her life, and then she unfortunately went deaf the last couple of years, and then she learned sign language. Wow. You know, and it's like, you cannot tell me that this is not a thinking, empathetic being, and if there is anything like a soul out there, this thing has it, you know?
Well, we got three dogs at our house, and they know all the words but no, so.
God, you know, it's a disease, actually. My dogs have that exact same disease. It's actually a plague. So we don't talk about it much. Like, COVID got all the hype, but this dog no deafness that's spreading through the land.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it was the empathy side was just, I took all my friends who work in like animal rights and animal rescue, who mm-hmm. really truly like think, you know, plants and animals and ecosystems deserve equal rights with humans. And I just rolled that into, okay, that's the world. Yeah. Like that's a huge chunk of the world agrees with that. And I will tell you, by the way, not that I make this argument in the book, though I do poke at it a little bit in Last Tango. It's a hard discussion when you start getting to trees. Because tree consciousness and tree neuroscience are real things. 20 years ago, you brought that stuff up, scientists would laugh at you. I've been at plant neuroscience conferences. Plants process information with the exact same neurochemicals humans do. They respond to information and communicate in real time using pheromones. They exhibit altruism. They exhibit empathy. They compete with strangers. It's like, it starts getting really weird.
Well, and a lot of that is willful ignorance on our side.
On our side, right?
Whether we know or not.
What's cool about the sci-fi world, though, is you get to like look at questions like that, right? Which, you know, like, okay, so we're growing steak from stem cells, so we can have, you know, basically pain-free, cow-free meat. And that's where that industry seems to be heading.
And people go, gross.
for some reason. Until meat prices go through the roof.
Right.
And by 2030, cultured beef like is cheaper than regular beef by a lot. And you can make it better for you, right? Yeah. Like we can take out the bad fats and put in the good fats, and like suddenly fast food burgers are good for you. That's what cultured beef allows. Plus we get to save the planet.
It seems like a no-brainer, but you have to have a brain for it to work, you know?
Or the market. The market sort of will take care of, you know, a lot of that stuff.
Money is the grand equalizer. For better or for worse, kind of with everything, you know. Speaking a little bit on Lion Zorn, he's no Jack Reacher, and I mean that in a good way.
No, he's really not.
You know, he's really a normal guy, so to speak, outside of his abilities. But he can still get his butt kicked and stuff like that. That was kind of a refreshing approach. Was that something that you wanted to do? Like instead of like the super macho, you know, have someone more. I mean, it's hard to say relatable because of his abilities, but you know what I mean.
I think it was three things. One, it was a storytelling thing, which is when I first started writing fiction years ago, 30 years ago, I thought the goal was to write as far away from yourself as possible. That's why they called it fiction. That's actually what they call bad fiction.
Yeah.
Because you just don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Right. Like, I mean, like it doesn't, like that was actually bad fiction. It didn't work.
I feel attacked because that's kind of how I live my life, just not knowing what the fuck I'm doing.
So I had to create a character, at least especially in a protagonist, when faced with an emotional situation, I had to ask the question, well, what would I do? I didn't have to do that, but I just had to like ask that, what would I do? What would my friends do in this situation? How would we feel about this situation? Because the technology may change, the world may change, and we may become more animal and plant friendly, but we're still the same, you know, kind. So I wanted to do that. Also, I am absolutely fucking sick to death of, you know, of heroes who have to beat their way up to become heroes. Because I mean, like, honest to God, I mean, we get it everywhere in the movies and television, whatever. I don't know anybody in the world like that. And I grew up around bikers and crazy people and whatever. And they didn't want violence was the thing you got to at the end after you tried all the other stuff. it's not the like the first thing out. And violence has a nasty way of escalating in stories. So if in this first scene, it's a fist fight, by the last scene, you're blowing up the White House. Yeah. Right. And like, and that's just storytelling. That's so true. And I wasn't interested in blowing up the White House. You know what I mean? I wasn't interested in not, I have some explosions in the book, and don't get me wrong. There is a flying motorcycle chase scene. And I think it's the first one in literature. So I did all that stuff, but I wanted to write a character I could know. I wanted to write a hero I believed in. And I also like, it's the funny thing about violence. Like, I was a competitive martial artist as a kid. I got punched and kicked wrong in a tournament fight. Mm-hmm. I just missed a kick and it got followed by a punch. And I was, not only did like they shatter my entire face and eye socket, but it took 10 years and a bunch of surgeries until it was right again. You see, that's what violence in the real world is a lot like, uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, that's what really happens. And so these scenes were like, people get beat up and then they get back up again. Well, okay. Mm-hmm. But like, that's actually not the experience of real people in the real world. And if you're going to create this like futuristic noir world, one of the things about those worlds, it tends to be, there's a lot of, they're real. They're very much like this world. And I just wanted to do a sci-fi thriller that's closer to like this world and closer to like the people I know. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, the people I know are empathetic, nerdy, smart, you know, streetwise perhaps. And they're not going to, like, violence is the last thing they're going to do, because like, there's always somebody willing to be more violent than you if you go down that road.
That's a true statement.
I grew up with a friend who became an enforcer for the Hells Angels. And I mean, like, this guy kept me alive for years, and he was in and out of jail and was an enforcer for the Hells Angels. He wasn't that big of a guy. And at one point I asked him, I said, why, how can you do that job? Like, why you? You're not that big. And he said, oh, I'm just willing to do far more violence than anybody else thought possible.
It takes a kind, though.
Like, oh, okay. I mean, you know, by the way, the last I heard of him, he rolled a van in the Arizona desert and had like an arsenal in the back that was big enough to start a war. And he's been in jail ever since.
Oh, no.
But yeah, I mean, like, those people are very, they're real. Like, you go down the violence path and sooner or later you start bumping into those people. And if you want a real world, you know what I mean? Like, that's a slightly different world than what I was trying to create. I wanted, again, our world, as close to our world as I could get, but just these problems solved. And, you know, the other problems we were dealing with.
Well, speaking of problem solved and looking at the world that you've made, as listeners read this and they get motivated to make change, because I'm sure they will, what actions do you think they could take to help the world around them, around us? Like, where do you start to be a better person after reading this stuff with
expand
empathy?
Your circle of empathy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
so, I mean, I always start with the neurobiology, and if you want to expand empathy, right, there's three tools at your disposal. The four tools: you psychedelics, nature experiences, that'll work. Flow states, right, in nature. I mean, you go for a long hike in the woods and kick yourself, drop into flow, runner's high along the way, and that'll work over time, right? You can also use just any loving kindness meditation, Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin studied Tibetan Buddhists with 10,000 hours of couch time or cushion time. And it was a loving kindness practice that he studied. So we've got really good data on how that works and how that expands empathy. I always tell people, start with the simplest one. I always think empathy starts at home, and you can start just by running a really neat experiment on the plants and animals in your life. Just literally, if you have dogs in your life, start treating for 2 weeks. Think about your dog as if it had equal rights to you. It's got all the same feelings, got all the emotions. It's got like all the same rights in a sense. So what would it be like to interact with that way? Or think about plants as, oh, wow, they're a lot more conscious and aware. Just start. That expands our sphere of caring. Once you follow your, how do you expand our sphere of caring? curiosity,
yeah,
information, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, this was sort of the great brilliance in, you know, when they put Cosby on the air and when they put Will and Grace on the air, a lot of those shows were designed mm-hmm. to put other black people, gay people, into people's living rooms.
Yeah.
So like
to normalize,
automatically go, yeah. Oh, like us, not mm-hmm. like them, and expand. Right. That's all you do to expand the sphere of caring. You decide something is more like you than unlike you. And so once you start thinking about the plants and animals, that will start happening naturally, which is really cool. And you could run any of these experiments, right? Take your pick. The cool thing about this, so there's also a good neurobiological peak performance reason to run this experiment, which is this. We take in a colossal amount of information every second. Just the senses gather about 11 million bits of information a second. But most of the information in the brain comes from the brain itself. So like that 11 million bits is met internally by a huge other number of bits.
Yeah.
Consciousness, all the shit that is like rises up and could be aware of is about 2000 bits. So it's this giant reduction. What we can actually pay attention to is even smaller. It's 200, 300 bits. And listening to me talk, by the way, you're using about 60 bits of RAM. So that's a way to know, right? So conscious, like what we actually are paying attention to is really tiny. Normally, we have a negativity bias. And what that translates to is a 9-to-1 ratio between negative information we take in and positive information. We do this because the brain evolved and it's, you know, in a time where like every danger could be life-threatening. So yeah. We're tuned.
That lizard brain's always in control, so to speak, in the background, kind of like
exactly.
Preserving yourself.
How do you how do you change that ratio? How do you switch it from like, you know, take in less negative information, more other information? One of the key ways to do it is empathy. And the reason this is a big deal is once you start letting in, most of the negative information that we let in it's already familiar stuff, right? It's stuff we're already worried about, we're already scared about. And it's usually not that new. It's usually old fears it's reigniting. And all creativity, all innovation, all opportunity, entrepreneurship, all that stuff comes not often from the things that we've seen a million times, comes from noticing novelty. And if you start tilting this ratio with empathy, you start noticing new details about the environment. You will, if you do this sort of exercise with your dog, for example, after a couple of weeks, you'll start noticing things about canine behavior that you've never seen before. You're suddenly going to be like, oh my God, my dog is a totally different person. Where'd all this signaling come from? Suddenly you're going to feel like you speak dog a little bit more. And it's a really neat experiment to run. So start there. And the other higher level, one step out, people don't realize this, but it's really freaking simple. We make the planet a better place environmentally one decision at a time. We know if you want to help the planet, we want to eat less meat. And, you know, chicken is better than beef and vegetables are better than chicken. Fish is better than chicken and vegetables are better than fish. And it's just better for the planet. I'm not saying become a vegetarian. I'm just saying every time you sit down for a meal, understand that you're making a decision that could make the world a slightly better place or a slightly worse place. Same thing with how you buy your groceries, how you buy anything. Do you buy car seats with leather? Do you need them? Do you have a leather belt or leather shoes? Those are, you know, do you need, you know, do you want cruelty-free clothing? These kinds of questions are how we start answering it. We mm-hmm. answer it with decisions and with our wallet. And it's really small.
It sounds like you're asking us to make better decisions to help ourselves and the planet. And that's just a bunch of bullshit. I'm not going to stand for that.
Yeah, I knew you were going to be hostile to this stuff. I knew it.
I think this interview is over.
Guys, I'm sorry. In my place, though, I've got never mind. Just stop there.
No, that is that's the hardest thing is change, you know, and it doesn't even have to be.
It's not though. Like, I don't know. It's not like you just have to do it is all. It's not that
habit
hard.
Is
you
a hell of a drug.
Knowing the difference is the hard part, right. You know, and once you understand that, it's,
Habit is a hell of a drug, which is why I think like you want to make it as easy for people as possible.
Yeah.
That's why I always say, look, environmentalism starts at home. Starts with how you think about like the plants and animals you already sort of care about. Don't like all this stuff is hard, but it's also if we don't solve these challenges, I don't like our chances of survival and neither does anybody else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Like that's just, and I've written books about optimism and technology solving grand, you know what I mean? And if I don't like our chances, unless we solve these problems, something's really wrong here. Mm. You know,
referring back to the book, are we going to see more of Lion in the future or what's next
so
for you?
I don't think the way I look at it is last their companion books. I'm mm-hmm. really not thinking that you have to read one first, one second, anything like
right.
that. But there is definitely, here's what I can tell you. There's a prequel to Last Tango that I don't know if I'll ever write, but I know what the story is. There's a book between Last Tango and Devil's Dictionary that's really, really clear. And as I was writing Devil's Dictionary, I was having a conversation with Ray Kurzweil, who is a futurist and the head of artificial intelligence at Google, and my writing partner, Peter's co-founder of Singularity University. And he... Ray knows that I work with dogs and he likes animals and Ray and I have countless endless arguments about where brain computer interface technology actually is. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, Ray believes in the singularity that we're going to get to a point with BCIs by the end of the 2030s, that we're going to be able to upgrade our brain and et cetera. And I think his timeline is wildly distorted and his neuroscience is wrong. And this has been a friendly argument for years between us. And he looked at me the last time we were together and he's like, you know, Stephen, the same brain computer interface that's going to let me talk to the internet, it's going to let your dog talk to you. So shut me the fuck up. let's just be clear on that one. It also gave me the goddamn next book out, right? Like, it's right there. I was like, okay, like I know where we're going next. I mean, it's right there, right? Like in this book, people are like you're able to sort of communicate with animals, but not verbally, and the animals aren't really talking back in human language. So in the next book, what happens then? And to think that, you know, Ray's predictions, right, mm-hmm. by the end of the 2030s, he's not wrong often. He hasn't really been wrong. His accuracy rate is better than, you know, it's in the high 99 percentile in terms of what he, like he's for everything, politically and technologically, he's just very good at this. And I think he's wrong on brain computer interfaces, but it does stop me and go, holy shit, sometime in the next 50 years, we can talk to animals, right? Like that's what he's saying. Like Dr. Doolittle moved me a lot as a child, right?
We did an episode of the show a while back. It was, you know, science in the next 50 years, 100 years. And we spoke to different scientists and academics. And it's staggering what they say, you know, using, you know, not going out on a limb where we'll be in the next 50 years.
So I don't know if you know this. So here's the Ray's shorthand, and this is what we wrote about in The Future's Faster Than You Think, is we are going to experience in the 21st century 20,000 years of technological change. In other words, we're going birth of agriculture to the Industrial Revolution twice in the next 8 years. In the next 10 years, it's 100 years of technological change by like the conservative estimates. So think back to 1922.
Yeah.
Fast forward to now and compress it into now to 2032. Holy crap.
Is there anything that you can see that is trying to specifically trying or malicious about it, but is there anything that is stopping or impeding that progress right now?
So the way you got to look at it is it's not a smooth, like there's 12 to 15 different lines of exponential technologies that are accelerated to produce this, right? Mm-hmm. They get interrupted. COVID happens, right? Mm-hmm. And so COVID shut down a bunch of stuff, but it also supercharged AI for drug discovery and AI for healthcare and a whole bunch of other things in the healthcare space, supercharged it. So where does all that AI research go after healthcare, just in case you were wondering. The next level down, the same AI that will discover new drugs is going to get you new foods. Yeah. So the reinvention of agriculture ends up spinning off of the healthcare jumpstart that COVID gave AI, right? And quantum as well. Quantum computing got a big push during COVID as well for the same reasons. So that everything that's downstream from those things, like the reinvention of agriculture, the material science, just got supercharged because of events. So it's not that things derail it per se, but I will, there's some caveats here, I think. It is that history tends to amplify certain things at certain times in certain ways, right? I'll give you another great example. This year for in the environmental good news story of the year, there are two great stories this year. The first is that we invested the venture world invested over $1 trillion in green energy this year.
Wow.
So we're having an oil war right now, basically. And the reaction to the oil war has been $1 trillion in green energy spend, which is bigger than the AI spend that happened during COVID, just to put that in context. So that's, you know, insane. Simultaneously, most companies that had bullshit triple bottom line goals now have real ones. This is the year that I thought it was just something I was looking at and I was seeing. And then I started talking to people about it. And then the Harvard Business Review did a big article about it. And so now it's sort of like more accepted. Like, this is the year that companies started to really understand environmental bottom line and how the environment impacts the bottom line and things like that. So those things, we're seeing the environment has everybody's attention right now for obvious reasons. And we're seeing that stuff move apace because climate change is really exerting a lot of pressure right now. So it depends on global events, what's going faster, what's going slower on a certain level. And some of this stuff is just like, we know virtual reality and augmented reality are going to explode over the next 3 to 5 years. That stuff is already happening.
That's something that I'm always amazed at how much that terrifies people too. The advent and the introduction of new technology still is met with, that's the mark of the beast or this or that. I see it all over the place. And it is the wrong time to be living if you feel that way about technology.
I spent a really long time. So Kevin Kelly, founder of Wired, one of the founders of Wired, wrote some brilliant books on technology. And one of them is called What Technology Wants. And he wanted to know, why can't you put Pandora back in the box? Like, what is it about technology that, like, once we discover it, we have to develop it. It just keeps going and growing. And he argued eloquently that technology is another form of life. It operates like an actual form of life, not like a thing that is inert. And I think he's right, perhaps, but I think there's a much simpler neurobiological explanation, which is it is freaking hard here on planet Earth, and it's hard for everyone. And technology is quite simply the promise of an easier tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's hope. It's the promise of hope. And hope is a really neurobiologically powerful, powerful drug. Hope and faith get us very, very, very far. And that's ultimately that side of the coin. The other side of the coin is we have aging populations. And one of the things about aging populations is they get conservative and resistant to change. And technology is massive amounts of change. And we all, as Daniel Kahneman taught us, we have loss aversion. Loss aversion is the terrible fear that whatever you have now, if I take it away, whatever comes next is worse. So we've got a lot of cognitive biases that keep us believing certain things. And the problem with technology is like the promise of hope is it doesn't, like, everybody gets the hope shows up during the hype cycle. And the hype cycle is really early. Like VR's hype cycle, virtual reality's hype cycle, was back in the 90s.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It was back in the 90s.
Yeah.
So things get really loud 20 years before they have that impact. Now that is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I think, there's also unintended, like social media may have been one of the largest disasters in the history of the universe.
That's an understatement, right? I think.
Like, yeah. There are just like, there are bad ideas, and then there are colossally bad ideas. That would be, you know what I, like, that would be filed under, it is no, it's not, the irony is not lost on me that they call it, like, WMDs stands for Web Mobile Device. I like the acronym. Yeah. I think it's appropriate. Right.
Or WoW, my it doesn't fit, but WoW, everyone I know is racist. it's kind of what I think of of social media for. It's terrifying, to say the least.
Yeah,
man, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Super fascinating, Stephen.
Thank you for writing such a fantastic book, series of books. And if everyone wants to not only follow your books, read, but to find you and listen, I know you have your Flow Research Collective Radio, but where should I send people, or where should they come to find and listen to you more?
StephenKotler.com is my website, KOTLER, and Stephen with a V. We're not French. No PHs. Do I look like a fucking existentialist?
P-H-U-C-K. Yeah,
exactly. Sorry. I recently met another Stephen with a V, and we spent 2 days talking about how much we dislike the PHs.
There's a movement.
A hatred you didn't even know you had. Yeah. StephenKotler.com. Flow Research Collective is me and all things flow. I am on our podcast, the Flow Research Collective Radio, which is a top 10 science iTunes podcast. And which I learned last week has fans in Mozambique. Okay. Nice. Just saying something. And you can find me on social media.
Well, we'll have links to all this in the show notes, guys, so you don't have to go far to find them. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for an amazing book.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. This was great.
Nation, we're going to break. We'll be right back with more Hysteria 51.
Oh, welcome back, everybody. Brent, man, Stephen's super fascinating. I found that incredibly engaging because it's stuff you've heard, but then it's stuff you haven't thought about what you've heard.
Well, I felt personally attacked the whole time he kept talking about people creating disruptive technology. I can't really put my finger on why, but for some reason, I just kept feeling... attacked by it.
Eat my ass.
It's a mystery. But I thought it was really cool to think about.
He's a smart cat.
Think about the like he was saying, you know, if technology is going in a certain direction on a certain trajectory, if something messes with that trajectory, there's all this other fallout that happens, good or bad, but it affects different things in different ways because of that one fallout. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's so cool
to dive in. I don't want to give too much of the book away. I never want to do that. But so when you guys hopefully do read into this, so the Devil's Dictionary, think of it as like, you know, like the Human Genome Project where they mapped it, you know, and mm-hmm. so they could do it. Well, this is a way to write the Devil's Dictionary, is something they write genomes and it makes it so they can make animals and things like that. And so there are exotic animals being made, and that's where their technology is going. It's a really cool, trippy, out there concept that is unlike anything I have read before. So it's definitely,
it also has a good message, you know, like it's always good to be more empathetic.
Unless you hate everyone and want to see them all burn, you're not going to like it if that's the case.
There were two thoughts I had on this, and tell me if this is dumb or not, but I am afraid he is mistaken about the first flying motorcycle chase in literature.
I thought to myself, that's a bold statement. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And the other thing was, he was talking about how we were running bits, you know, just listening was like 60 bits of RAM or whatever. Man, I got to tell you, somebody's got to get back here with an air canister and clean out this fan on me. I am running hot. It's easily 128 kilobits.
It is interesting, too, what he said, and this is so true, of the 921 negative info that you take in versus positive, because it is the whole fight or flight. You're taking in your surroundings. You're worried. You know, like I said, lizard brain. We've just been trained, not just our whole lives, but for eons, as you know, or you know what I mean, you know, as a species, to do that. It's a hard thing to try to switch.
It sure is. I mean, you said it. Habit is a hard thing to form, but if you don't think about it, that's the key. Just do it. Don't think about it. Think of something else. I've formed habits doing that.
Yeah,
for the positive. And yeah, it's easier said than done, of course, but something's got to give.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we are all going to give, you know, or the planet's going to give before anybody, you know.
I'm always interested in how, like, I love steak. Well, we can now make that exact same steak without killing an animal over my dead body. You know, sometimes that's
over my cow's dead body.
Yeah. So I don't know.
I mean, it's a psychological thing, right?
Right.
Did you ever see Snowpiercer, the movie?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. I know.
Remember how they'd give them those little jelly bricks that were just the
they're bugs, basically. Yeah, they were bugs. They're bug pate type stuff. Yeah. You know, or jelly.
And I'm sure in that world it did not taste good either. But if humanity had a way to do that, make it taste good, make it look good, and you know, tried to tell everybody it's not from bugs or don't worry about it or whatever, it's still gonna be tough to swallow when you find out it's made of bugs.
On multiple levels.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what do you guys think, Nation? Have you guys ever thought about the empathy world? Are you vegetarians? Do you think it's all a bunch of hubbub and it's all fake? We'd love to hear from you. You can tell us by, well, hopping on Facebook. Go to Facebook, look up Hysteria Nation, one of the evils of the world, social media that we were talking about previously.
He's right.
That's our Facebook discussion page. Also, facebook.com/hysteria51pod. That's our regular page. Patreon, patreon.com/hysteria51. Up All Nights, Mad Blurry Hysterias. Also, little teaser, Lisa, producer Lisa, just bought some food that I'm not allowed to look at. We're going to do a couple. She's got a Cafeteria 51, I think two of them, scheduled that she wants me to eat, and I'm not allowed to know what they are ahead of time, so that might be fun. Plus, our Mad Blurry Hysterias when Chris is available, and Blurry Hysterias, as you guys know. Voicemail 773-669-7277. Again, that's 773-669-7277. Or go to hysteria51.com, click on the little microphone, and leave us a voicemail there. And you can find links to everything else through that website. And then tell a friend, tell an enemy, you know, it opened up some dialogue. What you got going on in the world of everything that you got your fingers in, which is quite a bit? You're recording books and doing podcasts and making movies and, I don't know, porn. I don't know what you're all involved in.
Crazy. Yeah, I had to move the garden the other day too.
Is that a euphemism that I'm not hip enough to know about? Yo, baby, I'm gonna move that garden.
I'll let you learn it on the
street. If I could, I would be throwing up right now.
Yeah, I got a lot of stuff. We just ended the Miss Cryptid contest. Just announced the winner of that. That's a whole lot of fun. Month of May is over. Month of May was awful. Also finished a new audiobook, so that one should be coming out soon. I'll of course let everybody know when that is live on Audible. And the documentary is coming along nicely. We just had our second cut of the film. Now we put away the machete, we take out the scalpel, we do the finer details. It's getting there,
and very cool. Excited. Getting so nearer.
That's what's going on.
Nearer and nearer. Also, we're running a contest. I forgot to say, I should have mentioned this at the beginning. Leave us a review anywhere that allows reviews. Spotify. You can just leave the 5-star, give us a video, or not 5-star. You can give us whatever is in your heart, but take a photo or Apple,
but 5-star
Podchaser, anywhere that allows you to do reviews, take a screenshot,
5-star reviews,
and then go to Hysteria Nation. And there is in the pin posts at the top or the featured posts, there is one all this month. Just post a photo, and we're going to pick two winners and get prize packs, including T-shirts for both of them and other prizes. Lots of goodies. So it's an easy one. Doesn't cost you anything, and anyone who enters can do it. Just post that photo.
Of 5-stars.
And if you've left one before, there's other places to leave it. We're being, selfish. We crave external validation. So that's what's going on in the world. And go pet your pet. That's the takeaway. And do good out there. With that said, I've been Brent.
I've been David.
He's been Conspiracy Bot.
Stay woke, meat sacks.
It was terrible. It was just terrible. I'll never get over it as long as I live.
That's it for another edition of Hysteria 51. We'll be back next week with yet more of the unexplained, the unexplored, and the unheard of. Oh, if it's unheard of, how will they know about it? Anyway, if you want to suggest a topic, give us your thoughts, or just make fun of Conspiracy Bot, that's my favourite, join us in our Facebook discussion group, Hysteria Nation. Just log on to Facebook and search Hysteria Nation, or you can always tweet us at Hysteria51Pod.
You've been listening to a fourth-hand shine.